Good morning. It's Friday, September 7th, 2017. This is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. On today's show,
restorative justice stands in contrast with the punitive, retributive justice system that we deal with. It says when there's a harm caused, it's you versus the state. Restorative justice says no. What it is all of the stakeholders need to be taken into consideration.
Rocky Hop Holman works in schools and prisons to facilitate a process called restorative justice. It's an alternative to punishment, to prisons. It's a way of fixing harm instead of inflicting more. He'll speak to Janine Etter. Then, Gina Madrid with KPFA's own Javelin Richards about a new play that tackles race, gentrification, and the weaponization of calls to the cops. It's called 911, What's Your Emergency? That's all coming up next, after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump says it was unfair for someone claiming to be a senior administration official to anonymously write a New York Times editorial criticizing him because there's no way to discredit it. He suggests in a Fox News interview it may not be a Republican, it may not be a conservative, it may be a deep state person who's been there for a long time. At a Montana rally Thursday, Trump said the Times should reveal the anonymous writer's name.
The New York Times should publish his name at once. I think their reporters should go and investigate who it is. That would actually be a good scoop.
Trump's top lieutenants streamed forward Thursday to declare they didn't write it, including Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. Longtime U.S. Senator Tom Carper of Delaware easily fended off a Democratic primary challenge Thursday in the state from a political newcomer who was part of an anti-establishment wave that hoped to move the party farther to the left. Carper bested challenger Carrie Evelyn Harris. Carper said it's important now for the party to unite. He urged Harris and other young Democrats to stay politically engaged.
In some cases, we have people, young people, new people who've won in the exciting elections and statewide local races and so forth. I say congratulations to you. But I really want to say to the people who ran and maybe didn't win that this is not the finish line. You know, you have plenty of opportunities. You're young. You have plenty of opportunities to run again to make a difference with your lives.
Carper's victory sets up a November race against Rob Arlett, President Trump's former state campaign chair. Harris had hoped for an upset victory like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who beat a 10-term incumbent in a New York congressional primary in June, and Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, who beat an incumbent in a Massachusetts primary just this week. Twitter permanently banned right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his InfoWars show for abusive behavior. The ban came a day after CEO Jack Dorsey testified before Congress about alleged bias against conservatives on the platform. The company said Jones won't be able to create new accounts on Twitter or take over any existing ones. In a tweet, it said it would continue to monitor reports about other accounts potentially associated with Jones or InfoWars and will take action if it finds any attempts to circumvent the ban. Twitter said Jones posted a video on Wednesday that violates the company's policy against abusive behavior. That video showed Jones berating CNN journalist Oliver Darcy for some 10 minutes in between two congressional hearings on social media. Jones addressed the ban on his InfoWars program today.
Well, I was taken down not because we lie, but because we tell the truth and because we were popular. And because we dared go to that committee hearing and stand up to the lies of mainstream media and speak the truth.
Jones had about 900,000 followers on Twitter. InfoWars had about 430,000. Jones is best known for spreading unsubstantiated conspiracy theories. He's currently being sued for defamation by the parents of two of the children killed at the Sandy Hook school shootings for saying the shootings were a hoax. California state lawmakers supporting a California version of net neutrality bill based on the Obama-era rule preventing companies from limiting internet access are urging Governor Jerry Brown to sign it into law. SB 822 is in response to the Trump administration decision earlier this year to scrap net neutrality. Pacifica's Dan Fritz reports.
So far, Governor Brown hasn't taken a position on net neutrality at all, and his lack of position worries supporters of the issue. Mary Lizardi with the Courage campaign urged the governor to do what she says is the right thing.
Protecting access to the internet and the free flow of information online is critical to our democracy, and we expect Governor Brown to be on the right side of history.
Backers say that California's net neutrality law would be the toughest in the nation. Some other states are imposing their own laws to ensure internet companies can't throttle traffic or slow down the connections to certain sites. But California's law would also stop a practice called zero rating. That's when internet companies exempt certain traffic from data caps, driving more traffic to those favored sites. Dan Fritz, Pacifica Radio, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Fights over teacher salaries and working conditions are escalating across the West Coast. They're emboldened in part by the momentum from strikes and more conservative states. The disputes are particularly acute in Washington state. It's a state that has infused at least $1 billion for teacher pay to resolve a long-running court battle. With students returning to school over the past few weeks, teachers in at least 18 public school districts so far have voted to authorize a strike, have gone on strike, or settled their strikes in order to get pay raises. In California, teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District, the nation's second largest, also voted last week to authorize a strike. The teachers on the West Coast are tapping into a shift in public sentiment that supports better wages for teachers that come with a Red for Ed movement that began earlier this year in West Virginia. Authorities are still mulling whether to reopen a major highway today that's been closed for 2 days due to a raging Northern California wildfire. Officials must first determine if it's safe to resume travel on a 45-mile stretch of Interstate 5 below the Oregon state line. The road was closed on Wednesday as the fire erupted on both sides of the highway. Fire officials say work crews have cleared away burned and abandoned trucks that littered the road after the swift-moving blaze erupted, but they must also determine whether charred 70-foot trees along the road are in danger of falling. The Delta fire has burned more than 34 square miles and prompted evacuation orders for scattered homes and buildings in three counties in and around Shasta Trinity National Forest. The owner of two Northern California senior care facilities denies residents were abandoned as wildfire swept the area last October. Oakmont Senior Living responded Thursday after state regulators moved to revoke licenses for two of its Santa Rosa facilities. State investigators contend that at least three residents were never evacuated and that more than 20 people would have died if family members and emergency responders hadn't helped them after staff fled. The company says the allegations by the Department of Social Services are unfounded. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 70s, lows tonight in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot with highs around 100. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 7:30 on KPFA.
Good morning. It's 7:08, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter. The judicial system in the United States is based on the idea that when a crime is committed, a punitive form of justice follows. Within the restorative justice model, the terms of restoration are ideally negotiated between the perpetrator and the victim. To talk more about restorative justice, we speak to Raqui Hip Holman, a restorative justice facilitator at Community Works West, where he supervises a transitional age youth program known as TAE for youth coming from the county jails in San Francisco. Formerly, he was a restorative justice facilitator for the Insight Prison Project at the Central California Women's Facility. So, Raqui Hip Holman, thank you so much for joining me today.
No doubt. Right on for having me.
So, what is restorative justice? How does it work?
I think a lot of people, when they think of restorative justice, they think of the conflict resolution piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Okay, so people have an issue, you know, or someone causes harm to another person. And you have this process that seeks to hold the person who caused the harm accountable, as well as possibly pay some kind of restitution that doesn't necessarily have to be monetarily, right? So, I mean, that's the conflict resolution piece of it. But really, it goes much deeper, right? Because restorative justice stands in contrast with the punitive, retributive justice system that we deal with, right? That says when there's a harm caused, it's you versus the state, right? Restorative justice says, no, it's not you versus the state. What it is you've caused a harm, someone has been harmed, there are stakeholders, there's family members that are affected, there's a community that's affected. All of the stakeholders need to be taken into consideration, right? It also looks at what you've gone through. You know, there's this phrase that we have, hurt people, right? So it looks at
what the perpetrator's gone through.
That's right. That's right. To understand why you've done what you've done, right? And so it's about accountability, but it also is about restoring the relationship, because restorative justice looks at a breakdown of relationships. And that's when it starts to get deeper into the kind of the philosophy, you know what I'm saying? Let's go ancient, pre-colonial, I want to emphasize that, pre-colonial practices that, you know, African folks practice. Actually, there's a bunch of different ancient indigenous folks. The way that we practice it currently is rooted in the indigenous practices. But, you know, going all the way back to ancient Africa, you familiar with the truth and reconciliation process that happened in South Africa, right?
Yes.
In the wake of apartheid, right?
Right.
So that was actually a return to ancient practices that the South Africans used. They have this word, Ubuntu, right?
I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. That is the core essence of restorative justice, right? And it's the interconnectivity of all living things, right? Your humanity. My humanity is tied in with yours, basically. It's a bunch of different ways that, you know, people talk about the word Ubuntu, but that truth and reconciliation process was them returning to the practice of Ubuntu to address, you know, a serious, serious harm. It involved W.D. de Klerk, who was the president at the time of South Africa, and Desmond Tutu. He represented the people, right? And essentially what happened was they came together to address the harms that were committed during the apartheid, and a lot of it was about getting restitution for the Africans. You know, the white Dutch descendant minority were in power, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what Nelson Mandela was jailed over, right? Were imprisoned over. They decided that they would practice Ubuntu and sit down and try to actually find ways to pay restitution for the people of South Africa, Africans mostly.
What are some of the success stories, or maybe if you can tell one, in the restorative justice practice that you've been involved in?
I've seen so many. I want to start off by saying that I've done this work. I've done it in jails. The Richmond Jail, I did it at Camp Sweeney. I did it at Child Chiller Prison with women inmates. That was heavy. But I know cats who have gone through this particular one of these curriculums, the Victim Offender Education Group, right? Vogue, that's the name of this curriculum. Shout out to IPP, Insight Prison Project, for this curriculum, which was developed by inmates in San Quentin in conjunction with folks that were out in the community who wanted to implement this practice. But I mean, I've seen cats who had life sentences for murder be released in part due to their involvement in this restorative justice curriculum, specifically this one, Vogue. I can count five or six cats that I know right now who had life sentences for murder that are free and are back in the community doing the work, you know what I'm saying, which just, I love it because it, you know, flies in the face of this narrative of, you know, that you hear a lot of times and on the right about redemption and people's ability to, you know what I'm saying? So that's one place. I mean, I know I can count on one hand six cats that I know, because the irony is that CDCR, the prison system, California prison system. They actually really like this curriculum. So, which made me skeptical. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, word, y'all are into it. Okay, what's the catch? But they love it. We love it. The folks inside love it. It's consensus. You know what I'm saying? Because it's that deep. It's that real. And a lot of it has to do with when they go through that process, when they go and they sit in front of the board and it's time to actually talk about their crime and their accountability and all that. They've had this language, this narrative, this understanding, this reframing of what it is that they've done, what they've gone through. And it shows up when they sit in front of the board, and that's it. That's that piece. That's that piece that gives them their freedom. So in terms of the folks, though, that I work with, I got this one cat that I was doing that same curriculum with in the Richmond jail. And I think it's maybe been about 2 years now. And he loved it. He absorbed it. And he got out. And, you know, he had some substance abuse issues and all that. He had substance abuse issues, violence, all that. And he's super functional right now. He's got a couple of jobs he's holding down. He's about to get off probation. He's doing his thing. And he keeps in contact with me regularly, let me know. And he was really thankful for it. And that's the thing I be telling these cats, though, when I'm up in there, when I'm like, yo, understand this, though. All I'm doing is holding a safe space for you to work it out yourself. You know what I mean? That's all I'm doing. But I get so much out of it. I get so much out of it. It keeps me from, you know, because we all...
Optimistic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. We all deal with it. You know, we all deal as a relatively young... urban working class black male in this country, you know, I come from some, you know what I'm saying, from real situations, and this practice and practicing it with them inside keeps me righteous.
And what about the victims? What success stories do you have from their side?
You know, that is actually a really good question. I've seen it in so many different ways. I want to tell this story because it highlights a lot. So doing this work, I met this cat, this older white dude, actually, who was the victim of a really pretty brutal crime. This group of young black dudes jumped him and beat him unconscious. He ended up in a coma. When he came out of the coma, I don't even know how he heard about it, but he opted to do what they call a victim offender dialogue, a VOD, a VOD, with this young cat who was serving time in prison for this, right? And so this is that one. This is that one that I think people really think of when they think of restorative justice, just straight up conflict mediation kind of thing, right? So they went through the process, and, you know, and I want to say a lot of times when you have those kind of meetings, the prep work is the most important piece. It's the most important piece, and it's the longest piece, right?
How so?
Because you have to get people prepared to have this conversation, right? You have to go through all of it. You have to, you know, you got to sort out. There's restorative questions that you ask, like the basic stuff.
Before they even meet together.
Exactly. You know, what happened? What were you thinking at the time? How are you affected? So on and so forth, right? But there's also the prep of what do you do if you're triggered? You know what I'm saying? For both parties.
During the meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you handle these situations? How do you deal with this? What do you do about that? What if the person gets angry and loud and upset? What if someone breaks down and cries? You know what I'm saying? So that prep work, and then in some cases, when you don't have a direct victim, you can have a surrogate victim too. like someone who sits in place of the actual victim. I'm saying that there's a lot of that that happens too.
If the victim is unable to be there.
Unable or unwilling.
Or unwilling.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you find a surrogate, someone who may have had a similar situation, you know, but been harmed in a similar way, or a family member, you know what I'm saying? A surviving family member in some cases. So in this particular case, these cats, they did the prep work. They got it together. They met this 25-year-old black dude and this, you know, 60-something-year-old white dude. And it was incredible. They healed. They came to an understanding about where each other were coming from, why, how, all of it, just the whole thing, right? And the young dude actually was finally released from prison. And here's the irony. So the two of them wanted to get together and put together like a little talking tour because they realized how impactful their story was collectively, right?
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to work on writing a book together. They wanted to do like a little speaking tour. And the court won't allow them to be around each other. The stay away order because of the crime, right? So they can't even be around each other. The older white cat tried his damnedest to get it lifted, but it's not happening.
Right, and that's kind of another question. Like, how does restorative justice override or work in conjunction with the system?
So another program at Community Works West, big O Community Works West, Restorative Community Conference, and this one is pretty pretty revolutionary. Let this be known. Let this be heard. We have a program that if a youth who's charged with a felony, and that could be anything, you know, I think it's like if you steal something over $900 or something like that, right? You know, it's kind of iffy on a violent crime. You know what I'm saying? It depends on the nature of the violent crime. But generally speaking, if there's a youth being charged with a felony, they can go through the restorative process in lieu of this felony with our organization. So the way that works is they meet with the person who they harmed, right? And they bring all the stakeholders. The person who was harmed brings all the people they consider, you know, their support and people who may have been affected vicariously or whatever through, you know, what happened with them. The young person brings in who they think is the support. If there's a police officer involved, they show up. Whatever it is, folks come together. They go through that restorative process and they look for a way for the young person to maybe pay some sort of restitution. It could be in the form of literal work that you're going to do now to, you know, make me that money back, right? Or it could be, you know, my thing is I want you to, you know, go to KPFA every Friday and clean up or, you know, go get involved in this social justice movement. Whatever it is, they just think of different ways for the youth to repair the harm. And they all come to that agreement. They have to come to that consensus after that restorative process. It's dope. It's incredible.
And do you think that restorative justice is a complement to the American judicial system or an alternative?
I don't trust the United States government to handle things well. I mean, and I know everything is a process. It's a long, you know, God's wheels turn slow or whatever, right? So right now it's a compliment. I'd love to believe and think and have hope that it would be an alternative in general. But then there's something else that when you ask me that, something else comes to mind, which is a lot of us actually feel like restorative justice needs to be protected, right? It needs to be protected from being co-opted. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of money out there right now for a lot of restorative justice programs. It's not only happening, by the way, in you know, jails and prisons, right? But we're doing this in schools. Like, there's a whole thing. I can get into this whole thing about the ways certain schools, specifically middle schools, have been entirely transformed and have completely restorative practices where youth haven't been suspended, where there are no more fights at the school, and where the peers, it's a peer-to-peer model where they're doing restorative justice with each other when issues come up. Shout out to Our Joy, Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. Big up to my counterpart, Malachi, over there at Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. They were pioneers in getting restorative justice into schools. But the thing is, what I mean about it being co-opted is, and there's all this money for it, especially here in the Bay Area, you know, you don't want to, you can go through this or else, you know, start using it as a threat or a weapon or, you know, you get what I'm saying?
But like, have you had any resistance to youth wanting to be involved in restorative justice?
There's definitely been resistance. It's funny. I mean, there's been resistance from some parents who, this is interesting. Like, a parent goes, you know what? No, I don't want my kid to go through this restorative process thing. I think they need to go to jail. I think they need to go to juvenile hall or whatever, which is, you know, we can get into the psychology behind that, but, you know, I've seen that kind of resistance. That's not what I mean, though, in terms of it being co-opted. I mean, you can hear some local government officials talk about, you know, wanting to implement restorative justice kind of on a statewide or citywide level. You know, oh, let's make this a restorative city. Right. But there's this attitude that, you know, you all go out and do this work. You restorative justice practitioners, y'all go out, you go do this work. But we're going to continue to carry on, you know, with the hierarchy and bureaucracy. And the way that restorative justice has been really successful is when there's a buy-in from everybody. So, for example, of them schools, right? The staff, they have to buy in, right? The staff, the principal, you have to get off that way or approach, you know, the crime and punishment approach. All the staff need to be trained on it, all the way down to the janitor. You know what I'm saying? Everybody needs to buy in. Even some of these organizations. Okay, we call ourselves a restorative justice organization. Are we practicing that with each other? Right? You get what I'm saying?
Is everybody willing to be brought to the carpet?
Exactly.
For the restorative justice process?
Yes, that's the question.
Where are some places that people can go or organizations that people can look into if they're interested in restorative justice?
Community Work West, Community Works West, Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, Insight Prison Project, Seeds. As I mentioned, my counterpart, Malachi, we got a little consulting team called Restorative Justice League, where we offer trainings, we offer to hold circles for people. A lot of it, too, also involves restorative reentry, which is what I'm, you know, the program that I'm supervising is Restorative Justice Reentry. And if people are interested, they can get at me at HIP007@gmail.com. Also, there's a project I have out there called 99-1, Looking Forward, Back, and Now. It's basically hip-hop instrumentals with speeches, different progressive speeches from, and, you know, I call it progressive propaganda. Sure, let's call it what it is. And it's different speeches from people like Michelle Alexander, my sister, my good friend, Dr. Joy DeGruy, Michael Moore, Arundhati Roy, Noam Chomsky. And, you know, there's a lot of social justice and healing. So I guess we could say restorative justice as well happening on this project. It's dope. You know, golden era hip hop with progressive speeches. Y'all can check that out on iTunes, 99-1, Looking Forward, Back, and Now.
Well, Rakeem Hip Holman, thank you so much for joining me today.
Right on. Thank you for having me. Big up.
That was Restorative Justice Facilitator Rakeem Hip Holman. He currently works with Community Works West as a supervisor for a transition age youth program known as TAE for youth coming from county jails in San Francisco.
It's coming up on 7:30 in the morning. Up next on Upfront, Gina Madrid speaks with KPFA's own Javelin Richards about a new play that tackles race, gentrification, and the weaponization of calling the police. The play is called 911. What's your emergency? I'll discuss it next, after the news.
I'm Max Brungle with these headlines. President Trump says it was unfair for someone claiming to be a senior administration official to anonymously write a New York Times editorial criticizing him because there's no way to discredit it. He suggests in a Fox News interview, it, quote, may not be a Republican, it may not be a conservative, it may be a deep state person who's been there for a long time, unquote. At a Montana rally Thursday, Trump said the Times should reveal the anonymous writer's name.
The New York Times should publish his name at once. I think their reporters should go and investigate who it is. That would actually be a good scoop.
There's Trump's top lieutenants streamed forward Thursday to declare they didn't write it, including Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. New York and New Jersey launched new investigations into the Roman Catholic Church's handling of clergy sex abuse allegations Thursday, as the number of similar inquiries around the country continues to grow. In New York, the state's attorney general issued subpoenas to all eight of the state's Catholic dioceses, seeking any and all documents pertaining to allegations, findings from internal church investigations, and payments to victims. That's according to a law enforcement source familiar with the investigation. In New Jersey, State Attorney General Gurbir Graywall announced a new task force that will look at how abuse allegations were handled in the seven dioceses in that state. The presidents of Iran, Russia, and Turkey met today to discuss the future of Syria as a bloody military operation looms in the last rebel-held area of the war-ravaged nation, urging militants to lay down their weapons. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called for a ceasefire and an end to airstrikes in the northwestern province of Idlib, something that wasn't immediately accepted by Russian President Vladimir Putin and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Instead, Putin said through an interpreter that Russia and its ally Syria are trying to root out terrorism.
Our priority right now is the full annihilation of terrorism in Syria. With the support of the Russian Air Force, the parts of the southwestern parts have been liberated, and we want to just eliminate the terrorists in Idlib.
For his part, Rouhani demanded an immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country. A California agency has fined Disneyland, saying the theme park failed to properly maintain cooling equipment, leading three employees to acquire Legionnaire's disease. The Los Angeles Times reports Thursday that Cal/OSHA issued more than $33,000 in fines in March. Two of the three theme park workers were hospitalized last year. More than a dozen people caught the dangerous lung infection last fall in Orange County, and at least one died. The disease is caused by bacteria that can grow in man-made water systems. People can develop pneumonia after breathing in contaminated vapor. Disneyland has appealed and objected to the allegation that the park's cooling system caused the illness. Partly cloudy today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 70s, lows tonight in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot with highs around 100. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8 on KPFA.
Up front, the world premiere of a new play called 911, What's Your Emergency? Written and directed by Bay Area playwright Javelin Richards and starring cast of local actors is taking place at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley this Saturday at 7 p.m. 911, What's Your Emergency? Is an artistic response to gentrification, stereotypes, systemic racism, and the personal narratives of humanity. It's a groundbreaking and and timely work that examines white fragility as a result of the intersection of white supremacy and personal psychological narratives. Joining us today, we have the director of 911, What's Your Emergency, Javelin D. Richards. She is a playwright, writer, radio host, film and theater director, and solo performance artist. Ms. Richard is best known for her international solo performances and what she refers to as snappy-headed love stories, black love and intimacy. She published her first novel, Tulips for Evening, in 2016, and today she will be talking with us on her new play, 911, What's Your Emergency?
Yes.
Hi. How are you, Javelin?
I'm doing really good.
Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Gina.
So why this topic? Why did you choose this topic? Did it come up after the whole barbecue bakey?
Well,
what's your inspiration?
What happened was that we had some of the actors that would be there on Saturday night. We had just finished at the Exit Theater doing a piece called Ozales. Mm-hmm. And after that experience, the actors were saying they didn't want it to end. They wanted to stay together. So there's that sort of goodbye thing that happens where it's like, oh, we spent this time together. So I said, okay, now I'll think of something. I'm not sure what we're going to do next. Mm. So it's late at night. I've left the Exit Theater. I'm driving across the Bay Bridge. I'm thinking how pretty the bridge. I have on the radio. And they're talking about another 911 call. Mm. And another person being called for simply just doing whatever they was doing. And I thought to myself, you know, there needs to be a play about that, since I am a writer. Mm. The play was the first thing that came to my mind. And then I thought, that's it. That's it. And that was somewhere in July. And so then I went to La Pena. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, this is what I want to do. And they said, yes, because La Pena is my family. And what I mean by family is that they embrace their artistic projects for folks who may not have a mainstream appearance on stages. Mm-hmm. And they said, yes. And I went back to the same actors who said, we want to still be a part of each other. We want to be a part of you. We want to be a part of art. And I said, we're going to do 911. What's your emergency?
That's awesome. I'm actually grateful that you're covering this, because I feel like, you know, as a writer and artist, I feel like, there's always a responsibility to touch important topics. And this is, like you say, it has been something that it's ongoing. You know, it's important to talk about it. So you say the people who's in this play, it's people that you have already worked with.
I've worked with them before. And a couple other pieces. And I try to, a part of my methodology is to work with actors, and particularly actors of color, who may not be able to be in mainstream theater because mm-hmm. there's not a lot of work. Or if there is work, the roles are so stereotypical or diminishes their creativity or continues the theme of stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And so I try to stay with them, to nurture them, and to create a reality with us, a home, a family. And so they tend to show up in multiple productions, as well as new folks that I bring in. And at least twice a year, I do a residency through La Pena, uh-huh. where I act for folks who are at the intersection of oppression, and we do 4 or 5 weeks of really just being with one another. So I take my social work skills, my crisis training, my healing modalities, and as opposed to just teaching acting or being a director, I take all of that to nurture those spaces and the performers so that their authentic voice, if you will, can really rise up, and they can, whatever part they're playing, they can bring all of them to the role. So I like to nurture the actors. And I think that's a part of why they like to come back and be a part of this expression.
Right. So how many new people in this play that is like is the first time that you're working with them? How many actors are on this play?
We have 13 actors, and five of them are new. Yeah, five of them are new.
And what can people expect when they come to see this play? What is the message? I know you're talking about, you know, it's pretty much about the whole barbecue bakey and around
Kermit
that
Patty
topic.
And Patty. The others that have called. What folks can expect in the intentions of the play was to actually put 911 calls on trial as whether or not it should be a crime to call on a person for studying in their dorm, to use 911 as a way to control brown and black people moving in space, which is a historical narrative that goes back to post-slavery. Mm-hmm. And when black people in this particular moment were moving through their world, it became legal to stop them and to ask them any kind of random question and then to arrest them. You could be not a part of the legal system, just a white person, and ask the person, well, what are you doing? And he said, I'm walking. Well, they can create and call the sheriff and say it's a crime, and then you could serve time on their land, the person who called on you to serve them, to work their farm for free as your punishment. So it became one of those very complicated, racist, oppressive things. Mm-hmm. So now, in this court drama, what we want to do is to say, what if it was a crime? Then what are your possibilities at that point? And that's what people can expect to see. And they can also see the defense, because there's a defense team who is actually defending Barbecue Becky's, the Permit Patties, the student is calling on someone in a dorm room. So you have them defending them, saying they have a right to 911. And they have an interesting argument. And then you have the prosecution who is creating a sense of why it's a crime, and the witnesses. So you can expect to hear the witnesses on both teams. But here's what also you can expect to, when you come to this show. My goal was to change what a courtroom looks like. Mm. Not the rigidness of yes and no, but what happens when people have a chance to tell their stories. Going back to communities, ancient times, where the courtrooms where people could tell the story of why, the who, the what that happened. And that we were experiencing each other in this very human way. Not like, why did you slap that person? Did you slap them? Yes, no, and here's the evidence that you did. But to talk about the wound of a slap, the intentions behind the slap, the anger, the pain, the lack of human resources. So we're going to create, so it's creating a multiple stories, layers. We talk about immigration. We talk about ownership of land in terms of gentrification, like who belongs in this park. So they can expect to explore all of that in a way that we can digest that and see the different faces of what's really happening in the 911 call. It's not just a call and a person, but there's a stories that surround it.
Mm. Is there a particular thing that you would like the people to take home with them as a call to action or something that you would like them to do as they leave the space? Because I know, you know, as a performer, you come, you know, prepared to give a message, right? What is that that you would like the people to take home with them?
A call to truth. And it's not my truth or your truth, but our personal truth. Like, there is something fundamentally brilliant about people. And that is that we know right from wrong. We've been hearing it ever since we were small. Like, don't do that. Why, mommy? Why, daddy? Why, auntie? Because it's wrong. Well, once we introduce that to children, this is right and this is wrong. This is right and this is wrong. Something as simple of why can't I take this my brother, my sister, or this person's toy? Why must I share? Once we introduce the concept of right and wrong, it stays there. Even when we're doing wrong, it stays there. Even when we're doing wrong. So if folks could leave to reconnect themselves to truth, to their own truth, mm-hmm. so that when they see something called injustice, they can go to that place and say, you know what? Even though it might serve my temporary life to agree with this, so let's just say I'm a white person, and I say, even though this system may serve my temporary life, this is not right. What's happening? Mm-hmm. And I need to go to my truth, because the truth is permanent, yeah. eternal. It keeps going. So I'd like folks to take away that, to say, what is my truth? Why I'm in this temporary body? What is the truth? Sort of equivalent to love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Are you planning on taking this play on tour?
The answer is yes. It's always yes. As an artist, you do. Mm-hmm. Why open your mouth if you don't want someone to hear, right?
Right.
I pray that we only open our mouth if we've discovered something bigger than ourselves to talk about, right? So the answer is yes. And again, as an artist, it's about figuring out how to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Make it happen.
I hope you do. I feel like it's a very important topic. You know, we face it every day. There's like incidents happening all over the country, and not just in this country, you know, international, like racism, you know, it's internationally horrible.
Here's a brilliant thing about that, Gina. As horrible as this ism is, I also think that is the thing that everybody on the planet right now, on the planet, has been given the gift to resolve it. Given the gift to resolve it. Because that ism, it's not just black and white in America. It's an ism. It's a toxicity. Mm-hmm. It's an anti-human energy. And everybody on the planet, we have this gift to resolve it, to dismantle it. And I am one of those folks that believe in magic. No, not a rabbit out the hat. Not cutting someone in half, not making card games and being able to tell what the audience is thinking, but the magic of removing in the very moment the very thing that is killing humanity. There is a formula, and through art, I think we gather those elements of that formula.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe in magic, and everyone listening believes in magic. If you believe that you want to be in love, that you want to fall in love, if you want to, that's magic. Love is magic.
Yeah.
But why does it fail? Why does relationships? Because people don't know the elements of that love of magic. Because they bring in the toxicity.
Right.
They bring in the BS of it. They bring in the crazy making. Take care of my crazy loop-de-loop.
That's right.
It's true. But once we understand the magic of love, the magic of healing, the principles that belong to that, and I think art teaches that. And it's not like I'm smarter than anyone else. Absolutely not. Just learned how to tie my shoes. What it is that all of us are gifted with things, and I just happen to be gifted with the gift of story.
And you decided to take the direction of connecting your art with social justice and issues that matter.
It just shows up. It's like ghost. It's like
you had
Hanks.
You had that moment where it's like, where am I going to go with my art? And you can decide to really take your art where you're not really making much sense as the way you're giving it to the people. As there's a lot of people out there. But you are, you took a completely different direction that's actually making a difference.
Because we're on a planet to to dismantle this thing of the isms. And that's a part of why I'm into black love and intimacy. Now, that doesn't isolate any other group. But what it is that is to put that at the forefront of consciousness. Mm-hmm. When you put people of color's lives at the forefront of consciousness, you're putting the gifts they bring. The gifts they bring. Mm-hmm. When you oppress a people, you oppress their gifts. You oppress the solutions. You oppress the thing that carries us to other planets. You the elements of principles of love, all of those gifts. You can't have one without the other. If you oppress a group of people, you oppress their gifts.
Yeah.
Alice Walker said it in our mother's garden. When they could not have access to writing and reading, etc., where did their gifts go? In their case, it went into their gardens. You cannot oppress people without oppressing their gifts. And you cannot have a full life, a life of value, without those gifts you've oppressed. You're just having a shell.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the premiere is this Saturday.
Saturday at 7 o'clock.
At La Peña.
At La Peña.
In Berkeley.
In Berkeley.
But I know the place is not that big, so definitely people, it's recommended to be there early.
To be there early.
It's a seated.
The doors open at 6:30.
Situation.
Yes, and it's a 6:30 open seating. And Surge is going to be facilitating the after talk. And Surge is showing up for racial justice. Mm-hmm. They're going to facilitate the back talk. And we always, jazz and blues are always, anyone who comes to my work knows that I have musicians there. Mm-hmm. There's jazz and blues. There's folks that's going to be meeting at the restaurant next door. There's a birthday party of a group of people coming to the show. And so they'll be over there. They're going to share cake when anyone who comes in and gets their tickets early. So if you show up at 6 o'clock, you'll get birthday cake. Then you come in the theater at 6:30. The jazz musicians are going to be doing their thing. And then the show starts. And I have a thing of not, I don't like to be on stage, although I won't be, I'll be directing it more than like an hour and 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's just my own, the way I like it to be. At about 8:15, you're done and now able to absorb what you experience and to be able to talk about that with other audience members. And then Mandisa Woods, who's also going to be there, she's a visual artist. Mm-hmm. She's going to do an impressionist painting while the show is happening. Okay. Yes.
Is that going to be for sale at the end of the show?
I don't know. It may be one of the things we give, but she's going to paint what's the energy of the room, uh-huh, the music, the language, the artist, and whatever happens for her.
That's great. And what is next for you on your plate?
What is next? One is just two things. One, I'll be in New Mexico in November. And I'm on, it's Fred Talk, mm-hmm, Fred Talk. So that is looking at art in the political form and talking about that, the impact of art. So I'll be doing TED Talks. That's November 1st to the 3rd, and that's in New Mexico. I can't even think of the event itself. But I'm also going to do another residency with another group of people and look at their personal lives, mm-hmm, and put those personal lives on stories to tell those stories. That empower their own lives and the communities that they serve. Mm. And that's the next step. And to find funding and continue finding funding and hopefully that 911 has legs and we can go somewhere else to another theater and do this healing wonderfulness. 911, what's your emergency?
911, what's your emergency?
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to share? How can people be in touch with you and find out about your work and just stay connected?
Yeah, thank you. www.javelinrichards.com. And my name is spelled J as in joy, O as in orange, V as in victory, E as in Eva, L as in love, Y as in yellow, N as in Nancy, Richards.com.
Awesome. And on social media, are you
Facebook? Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever else is going down. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You are welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. This was Jovelyn Richard. She's the director of 911 Was Your Emergency, a new play in response to gentrification, systemic racism, and the personal narratives of humanity. This all came after the whole Barbecue Becky permit party. So if you want to check this play out, you can stop by La Peña this Saturday, September 8th. La Peña is located in Berkeley, California, at 7 p.m. Be there a little bit early, 6:30, so you can get a comfortable seat. And we are giving a couple of pair of tickets to go see this play. We'll give it to the first two calls to call 510-848-4425. Again, the number is 510-848-4425. Two pairs of tickets to go see 911 What's Your Emergency at La Peña in Berkeley this Saturday at 7 p.m. We'll give it to the first two callers. The number is 510-848-4425.
And that does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media. If you'd like to give us feedback on something you heard or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Our producer is Corinne Smith. Our engineer is Kirsten Thomas. Our intern is Justin Gold. Hosts of the show are me, Brian Edwards-Tiegert, and Antonia Yuhas. Most Fridays, it's Janine Etter. Gina Madrid will be back on Monday. A big thanks as well to Mitch Jeserich and Eileen Alfandary for their contributions to the show. And if you are not in a position to get in touch with us by sending an email, you can do it by affixing a stamp to a letter. Send it to KPFA, Upfront, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94704. Stay up, stay tuned. Rising Up with Sonali is coming your way at 8 o'clock.